From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A recent poll by the think tank Data for Progress has found that, contrary to establishment Democratic claims, strong progressive policies are a path to electoral victory. The data was published in a report called The Future of the Party and outlines in detail what policies most people who identify as Democrats actually support. Data for Progress describes itself as providing research, polling on left issues, and analysis to support activists and advocacy groups challenging conventional wisdoms about the American public that lack empirical support. John Green is my guest. He is the co-founder of Data for Progress. Welcome to the program, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I have to confess, I was quite happy to see that an organization like yours existed, because you're right. We hear a lot of claims from Democrats about what it is that voters want, and they're rarely actually backed by data. We do have a lot of polling that's often done with very leading questions that end up offering results that are a little bit confusing to interpret. Was that the reason why you co-founded this organization?
That's one of the reasons. So this is actually the first poll that we've been able to fund and run ourselves. Up until now, we've been relying just on what's publicly available out there. And one of the things we've noticed in using publicly available polling is that the left's agenda, the policies that progressive candidates are running on, just don't make it into a lot of publicly available surveys because people don't think to ask them. I don't think that's like a conscious effort on the part of the people who are designing these surveys. They're smart people. They're putting together questions that they think people are interested in knowing the answers to. But we've seen recently a lot of energy on the within the progressive movement and among progressive candidates running on things like abolish ICE, Medicare for all, debt-free college, which we didn't get a chance to include in this survey, but we hope to in the future. And we just didn't know. Like, you know, pundits are out there claiming that these policies are going to be really problematic if they, wind up on the Democratic Party platform on a national stage. And we just don't have any information on whether or not that's the case. So we're really excited to sort of branch out in this new project for us and start pulling the left agenda.
So how did you conduct your poll? How big was your sample? Give us a sense of the methodology and how confident you are in the results.
Yeah, so we contracted with YouGov Blue, which is affiliated with YouGov. They're a very prominent pollster. And we got a sample of about 1,500 adults across the country, which we then weighted back to national demographics. So we're pretty confident. Normally these polls are done with fewer respondents. We wanted 1,500 because we do some techniques to get state level estimates, which you need a little bit more respondents for. But for now, we're just publishing our national top lines, and we're very confident that these are at least for now where these numbers stand. So as candidates start running on these issues and they become more familiar to the electorate, you might see these numbers change. But at least for now, with these policies, we're pretty confident this is where the numbers are.
Now, one of the things that jumped out at me was that people who identify as Democrats are very much embracing racial diversity and, by extension, want to see greater efforts towards racial justice. I suppose we shouldn't be too surprised because the demographics of Democratic Party voters and supporters tend to be more racially diverse than Republicans, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's the case. And that's a trend that's been increasing in recent years. So if you went back 10, 20 years, the sort of racial attitudes within the Democratic Party were probably more diverse. And now we're seeing the voters within the party becoming more committed to racial justice and making that link that if you identify as a Democrat, this is a trend the party's going in. You should be adopting these more racially inclusive attitudes.
And so how did you ask the questions? What were the sets of questions that you asked your respondents to actually respond to? Is it so did you do it issue by issue? Did you do it based on just simply asking them where they stood on certain broad-based issues or very specific questions?
Yeah, so for this round, we did a slate of policy issues. The questions would typically be like, would you support or oppose on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being strongly support and 5 being strongly oppose? And then the proposal, right? So, we have one that was a public option for internet. And the wording was something along the lines of, having a government-run internet company that would compete with private internet companies to fill coverage gaps in areas that currently don't have robust internet access. A slate of policy issues like that. So we have another one for providing generic versions of life-saving pharmaceutical drugs. We have a job guarantee question, universal basic income, ending cash bail for pretrial for people who are not flight risks or violence risks, and things like that. So that was the general format, was support, oppose on this policy proposal.
And the people that you surveyed, were they just 1,500 randomly sampled people or 1,500 people who identify as Democrats?
This was a nationally representative sample. So we had Democrats, Republicans, Independents. Mm. We were trying to get a picture of sort of the American adult population. Okay. We also have questions on who people voted for or whether they voted in the 2016 election. So we, our site, you can break down our respondents by people who say they voted for Trump or say they didn't vote, or a minor party candidate for that matter. We wanted to get a sense of sort of the general population.
So let's talk about certain issues. Immigration is a huge one these days. The issue of family separation and the Trump administration's harsh anti-immigrant policies has led to calls of abolish ICE, which have been ridiculed by Democrats, establishment Democrats, but actually supported by some progressive Democrats. What did you find in your survey on immigration and where most Americans lie on that specific issue?
So abolish ICE, I think at this point, is certainly polarizing in the general public, but has plurality support among Democratic identifiers. So in a Democratic primary, the candidate who supports abolishing ICE, defunding ICE, whatever verb and ICE you want to put to change what that organization is doing and prevent those sorts of policy outcomes, that candidate is going to be on the right side of Democratic identifiers. As the party is having this internal debate of like how hard a line do we want to take on what the Trump administration is doing to these families. This is another data point that this is where the base is, and the Democratic identifiers do not want to keep this organization around.
What about other racial justice issues? You looked at, your report points out that there is a much more favorable view that people who identify as Democrats have of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes. So we didn't have a question directly asking about Black Lives Matter in this poll. We have a question on reparations, which is one of those, talked about relatively frequently at a low level, it's been discussed for quite a while, very polarizing. So as you might imagine, white identifiers, Republicans, are very strongly opposed to economic policies that are designed, the question wording was policies designed to reverse the effects of slavery and Jim Crow. It's polarizing. It is net unfavorable. The public in general was not in favor, but among young people and among people of color, and more so among Democrats, there are pockets of support for this policy. We note in our write-up that reparations on net are less unpopular than the Republican health care bill. It's not a radical idea by any stretch of the imagination.
All right, let's turn to healthcare. And in our next story today, actually, we're going to be taking an in-depth analysis of the recent Koch-funded story on Medicare for All that shows that it has a giant price tag. But what did you find on the attitudes toward expanding our current Medicare program from seniors to all Americans, which has actually become an issue, thankfully, in the midterm elections, and just a few years before Bernie Sanders' candidacy for president, was a complete non-issue, was a non-starter.
Yeah, so this is a question we didn't include in this poll because it's been publicly polled and we had data on it previously, and we were able to conduct this more granular state level analysis on it. And this is one of our relatively consistent findings, is that Medicare for All is popular pretty much everywhere. It's got very strong support nationally. It's got majority support in the median state. This seems like voters consider this to be at a gut level a good idea. People are not satisfied with healthcare as it currently stands. I think it's the data are really pretty clear on this point.
In general, though, on government spending, on policies and programs that benefit ordinary Americans, what did your survey find? Because these days, the idea of socialism in general is becoming more popular. Socialism, you know, simply being government spending taxpayer money on behalf of taxpayers, programs that actually serve the needs of taxpayers. Did your polling find any particular direction where Democrats lie on government spending?
It really varies. So for some of these questions, for policies that will be expensive, we tend to include a clause in there saying this program will be funded by a tax increase on people making more than X amount of money. And we find that, you know, when you include that, stipulation support does drop a little bit because you're reminding people that, you know, we have to pay for these things. But even in those cases, so in this case, we had a pay for our universal basic income question. And even with that stipulation,
universal basic income. So basically the government offering a base level of income for every American.
Yes. Even on that question, at the national level, it was net negative two, right? So, you know, basically a coin flip as to whether or not an average American would support or oppose it. Among Democrats, it's popular, and it's certainly not a deal breaker for people. When you tell people that you have to pay for nice things, people still want nice things, I think is a fairly fair way to put it.
A big part of your report focused on non-voters. Let's talk about that. The Democratic Party, establishment wing of the Democratic Party, has long tried to win over centrist voters from the Republican Party to their party. Is that a losing strategy?
I don't know if it's a losing strategy, because I'm not sure that we have to choose between winning swing voters and winning non-voters. This is a big debate in the political science community as well, over whether swing voters exist in meaningful numbers, whether mobilization efforts among non-voters are a more valuable use of campaign resources. I think that these issues can be treated relatively independently to a certain extent. Certainly the kinds of policies that and proposals that would win your sort of Romney Republicans, your suburban pro-war, high-income Republican voters are probably going to turn off non-voters who you need to win an election. One of the things we're finding in our polling here is that policies like public option for internet, generic pharmaceutical drugs, ending cash bail have support in rural areas and among lower income white voters who probably voted for Trump in 2016 and who are open to a robust economic agenda from progressive candidates.
Hmm. Now, your report says that only 34% of individuals who identify as Democrats voted in all three elections between 2012 and 2016. It sounds like the Democrats have a problem of mobilizing their own voters.
Yes, definitely. So this is particularly because this is a coalition that relies on low-income, younger, and more mobile voters who face structural barriers to turning out to vote. Voter registration deadlines are in particular are a real impediment to people who are moving a lot. So this is going to disproportionately affect Democrats' abilities to mobilize their own base. So giving them a reason to come out and vote, I think, is particularly important for progressive candidates. You got to get people excited.
And so what in your report, is there anything in your report that suggests that adopting progressive, bold progressive policies would actually help mobilize more voters to vote for Democrats?
All we have right now is evidence showing that non-voters like these ideas. So, you know, non-voters are, in particular, this is all correlated with being low income, younger. These are all factors that predict, you know, being more likely to support bold progressive policies. So right now we just have this correlation. People who didn't vote previously like the progressive agenda. It has to be tested. Candidates have to take that bet that if they promise to improve these people's lives and follow through on it, then they'll be rewarded at the polls.
Poor people don't vote very much, as per your report. And I want to discuss that. Your report points out that the preferred candidate of the poor was no one in the 2016 election, with nearly one in two not voting. And that if low-income non-voters, meaning people just don't vote but are eligible to, would overwhelmingly prefer Democrats if they voted and would have been more than enough to shift the election outcome in favor of Democrats. But, of course, if the policies that the Democrats are adopting favor wealthy people, there's no good reason for poor people to vote for them, right?
I think there's a very real perception in low-income communities that the Democrats don't meaningfully address their core economic concerns. I think that's perfectly fair to say. I think it's still fair to say that the Democratic Party, as it stands now, for all of its flaws, is better than the Republicans, but that's, I mean, if you are struggling to make ends meet, that's not a very compelling reason to come out and vote for, you know, the least bad option. So yeah, I think in order to make a credible case to low-income communities that they have something meaningful to gain from voting for Democratic candidates, you're going to need to see a real change in substance and tone and respect for these low-income communities who are not wrong when they say the Democrats have not made the necessary efforts to make their communities better.
You say in your report that politicians from both parties dramatically overestimate the conservatism of the voters they represent, and that Democratic politicians falsely believe voters are less progressive. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so this is a finding that's popped up in a couple different places in the political science literature, that when you survey politicians, and there's a recent paper that's about to come out that I saw the authors being interviewed about recently, chiefs of staff and other congressional staffers in these politicians' offices, when you ask them what their constituents think on certain policy issues, you wind up with more conservative estimates than what you get if you actually poll those constituents. I don't know where the disconnect comes from. I think part of it is sort of the pundit's fallacy of thinking that people who you're thinking about also agree with you. But for whatever reason, you wind up with representatives who have every incentive to know what their constituents want and think, who underestimate the desire that there is for a progressive agenda in those constituencies.
So currently we have a president who lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. We have, of course, a huge problem with the electoral college system that enables such a thing to even happen. And so much, if you count the actual number of people who picked Trump to be our president, it is a minority of Americans. What would American politics look like if we had full turnout, or at least far higher turnout rates than we do now?
It's an interesting counterfactual to think about, because you would have to the Republican Party would have to change who it is in order to remain electorally competitive. So in a counterfactual setting where the candidates ran the exact same campaigns and the parties ran the exact same campaigns, but everyone voted and picked a two-party candidate, the Democrats, I think, would do a lot better. You would have to see some sort of adaptation on the part of both parties in order to appeal to this new electorate that they have safely assumed for a long time. Just it doesn't matter. They don't have to pay attention to. It would fundamentally change American politics.
Fundamentally change American politics if many more voters turned out to vote. So voter mobilization efforts are absolutely critical. What did you find in your survey about geographic variations in some of these beliefs, ideologies, and you know whether people tend progressive or conservative? We have an assumption that the coasts are much more progressive than the center of the country. Did that bear out in your survey?
It really depends on the issue. On cultural issues, there is an urban-rural divide. On a lot of these economic issues, the internet access is the one I keep coming back to because that's an area where the rural areas are really underserved by the market in terms of internet access. And urban areas are, high-income urban areas are very well-served. But there are plenty of urban areas where there is not great broadband. So this is an area, this is an issue area that spans geography, and we find strong support for a public option for internet, which would be, Republicans would call that socialism. But they're finding that these Republican voters in rural areas really like this idea. So it's one of those cross-cutting issues that really scrambles that narrative of there being a stark urban-rural divide and no one can agree on anything. People agree that internet access should be better and Comcast should have a competitor from the public sector.
But on issues such as Medicare for All, $15 an hour minimum wage, you've maps in your report showing that there's dramatically stronger support in states like California and New York than there might be in middle states, in the Midwest as well, in the Rust Belt.
To a certain extent, and even that depends on the issue. So support for Medicare for All is certainly higher in California than it might be in Kentucky, but that doesn't mean that it's not popular in Kentucky. Medicare for All is popular everywhere for the most part. It's hard to find a state, maybe Wyoming, where we don't have more people in favor of it than opposed. For the $15 minimum wage, you do see a little more geographic variation because the cost of living varies by geography. So when you when you test $15 minimum wage against other sorts of policies designed to raise the floor of economic well-being, things like wage boards and a federal jobs guarantee flatten those geographic distinctions much more than a $15 minimum wage does, because the $15 minimum wage goes a lot farther and is a much bigger increase relative to cost of living in rural areas than it is in urban areas.
Finally, your report also analyzed the actual votes of House Democrats and Senate Democrats. So those Democrats have already won elections, are serving in Congress. And what did you find both for House Democrats and Senate Democrats in terms of how well they represent the views and desires of their base?
So it varies by it varies quite a bit by representative. So the general idea behind this model that we ran was to take the Democratic caucus as it's currently constituted, right? So this is everyone's already won their seats. This is completely within party, and to see for any given vote, if you replaced a given member with a generic replacement who has the same Trump won the same percentage of their district, they're the same gender, they're the same. The same median household income in their district, all of that, how would that generic replacement vote relative to what the member is currently doing? And there are some members who are, because this is all within party, the errors are going to be symmetric. You're going to have some members who are more liberal than their generic replacements and some who are more conservative. And so we find that, to mention a few by name, we got like Mark Warner and Dianne Feinstein are in particular more conservative than their generic replacements would be in terms of how often they vote for Trump's nominees, for his policies, and just with the Trump agenda. And given that these are seats that are already held by Democrats, the idea is that a more progressive replacement would be viable in a general election. It wouldn't be electoral suicide for Democrats to replace these people with more progressive versions of themselves.
Well, the report is available on your website. Give out your website, and how do you hope that people will use the data that you've put together?
We hope that we can provide some empirical support for people who have that gut feeling that there's really no reason why our politics can't be more progressive. I think there's a, especially in the pundit class, but also in ordinary political discussion, there's this assumption that the left's ideas must be unpopular because no one's talking about them, because politicians don't take them seriously, because Politico doesn't write up. Doesn't assume that that these ideas are popular, and that's just not at all obvious. And so we're really just trying to change how people think about progressive policies and ground it in a little more the reality of actually asking the electorate what they want and what they think, and putting some numbers to what has previously been speculation.
And the website dataforprogress.org, where people can find that report. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, John.
Great. Thanks for having me.
John Green is the co-founder of Data for Progress. We've been discussing the new report, The Future of the Party. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.